the architect of the New Deal and her ties to Maine. There's a good chance you've never learned about Frances Perkins in your U.S. history class, but her contributions to American society are enormous. She was the first woman to serve as a cabinet member, serving as FDR's Secretary of Labor for 12 years. She's considered the architect of the New Deal, having developed and promoted the concept of a 40-hour work week, workplace safety laws, and overtime pay. She was also the driving force behind Social Security, unemployment insurance, and the minimum wage. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Frances Perkins had deep family ties to Maine, and throughout her career came back to her homestead in Newcastle to think, write, and recharge. Today, as part of Maine Calling's bicentennial coverage, the life and legacy of Frances Perkins. But first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Some of the most important social programs in U.S. history, including Social Security and unemployment insurance, exist thanks to Frances Perkins, the first woman to serve as a presidential candidate and a person whose legacy remains particularly relevant today. On this program, we're going to learn more about Frances Perkins, her 12 years as FDR's labor secretary, her ties to Maine, and more. My guests are Kirsten Downey, who is a journalist and author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor and Moral Conscience. Kirsten joins us from Hawaii. Closer to home, we have Sarah Peskin, board chair of the Frances Perkins Center in Damariscotta. Also joining us, the executive director of the Frances Perkins Center, Michael Cheney. Today's program is part of our year-long series of topics related to Maine's bicentennial. And as always, we want to hear from you. How much do you know about Frances Perkins? Do you have questions about her work, or have you been thinking about her as we've gone through this pandemic and the government has passed programs to boost things like unemployment? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. But quickly, before we turn to the life of Frances Perkins, Maine Public's Mal Leary is on the line with us for a couple questions about yesterday's primary election. Mal, both bonds passed. I don't think that was a big surprise. And Sarah Gideon won the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate, but really a commanding lead right now. The numbers look like 70% of the votes. Was that a surprise to you?
Not really, because all the polling that we saw that was public had her by a large margin. There was always the possibility that one of the other two Democrats would catch on a little bit and, you know, drive that number down. But it really paralleled what we saw in the polling. So Sarah Gideon was expected. If you think about all the television ads she's had on, a lot of Democrats didn't even know anyone was running against her until they walked into the polling place.
And I'm curious, too, about the fall election. It seems as though the campaign for that started today. Susan Collins already today appearing at several places, the Portland Police Department, Yodel Stoves, Moody's Collision Center.
It's been going on for weeks, if not months. This just incredible number of television ads, millions and millions of dollars have already been spent. And what is it, Jennifer? We're 4 months away from the election, and yet you've had expenditures far exceeding any Senate race in the past up to this point. So, I mean, this is just an amazing race where both parties think they have a chance, in the case of Republicans, to keep the seat, in the case of Democrats, taking the seat and maybe taking control of the U.S. Senate as a result.
All right. And another race that is on the national map, because some people believe that Jared Golden is vulnerable, is that second CD Republican primary. Mal, Dale Crafts at the top of the heap at this point, but not 50%. It's a ranked choice election. What happens next?
We go forward with a ranked choice vote tab, according to the Attorney General's office, who gave an opinion just a little while ago to the Secretary of State that said there's nothing in the law that allows the process to be skipped. If you don't get 50% plus one, it's going to be ranked choice voting, period. So even though his two opponents have conceded, and it's, you know, for all practical purposes, he will be the nominee because he only needs to pick up a very few votes from the second round of both Adrian Bennett and Eric Brakey in order to cross that threshold. So it's going to happen, but there's nothing in the law that allows the Secretary of State to say, hey, these people have conceded, so we don't have to do this. So the very laborious process is going to be underway of collecting all those ballots and running them through, even though we pretty much know the outcome already.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me. I want to ask you if you were surprised on that one. Eric Brakey was the earliest to begin campaigning, the earliest and one, some might say, the most vocal, even though Governor LePage campaigned for Dale Crafts. Governor LePage endorsement has former Governor LePage. His endorsement hasn't always been the kiss of victory. So were you surprised at all by the outcome in the second district?
Not really, because the only public polling that was out there showed Dale Crafts at around 37% with something like 19% undecided. Well, you know, some of those undecideds were going to go to Crafts. The big question mark and those of us who watched the race very closely was, will enough of them go to Crafts to hit that 50% threshold so that he avoids a runoff under ranked choice voting? Well, that didn't happen. So that process goes forward.
And the last question for you, what does this mean? All three were campaigning as big Trump supporters, but Eric Brakey with a libertarian background really to the right of the other two candidates in some ways. Does this say anything about the Republican electorate in Maine right now?
I would say that it's still very strongly supportive of Paul LePage. This is where his endorsement seemed to have paid off. He was in the TV ads for Dale Crafts. And I think that the problem that they have is it's not going to be Republicans who elect Crafts any more than it's going to be Democrats who elect Olson. How are the independent voters going to break down? And that's a big question mark that, of course, will be decided come next Election Day in November.
Well, Mal, thanks so much for taking a few moments for us. I know you had a late night last night. Mal Leary is Maine Public's senior political correspondent. Now we're going to turn to the topic of the day, which is Frances Perkins. And I'm so excited to be talking about Frances Perkins because her life is remarkable by any standard. Kirsten Downey, you and I first met more than 10 years ago in 2009 when you published a really wonderful biography of Frances Perkins. And I want to go back to that time, if you'll indulge me. People hadn't heard of her then. Why did it occur to you that you wanted to focus on Frances Perkins, dedicate a good part of your life into writing a biography of her?
Well, I was a reporter at the Washington Post for 20 years. And during the years that I was there, I noticed that as different news events came up, you know, when we talked about changes in Social Security or unemployment or the unemployment insurance system, again and again, one name came up. And I realized that there was a person who I wasn't even familiar with who was responsible for creating most of our social safety net in the United States. And I was amazed that I'd never heard of her, and I thought I wanted to know how she'd actually done so many things. And then I thought a lot of other people would want to know this too. And so that's how I came to write the book.
And as you were writing it, were you sort of perpetually surprised?
I was in perpetual shock. It almost got kind of laughable. It got to the point that it was like almost any issue you could say, well, was she in the room when that happened? It was really extraordinary.
I mean,
really,
the list is just extraordinary. Minimum wage, yeah. Social Security, laws against child labor, unemployment insurance, a 40-hour work week. What am I leaving off this list?
Infrastructure, public works.
right, of course, the New Deal. So, Sarah, I'll bring you into this conversation then. Sarah Peskin with the Frances Perkins Center. Sarah, I'm going to ask you a real simple question. Why is the Frances Perkins Center in Maine? She was born in Massachusetts. She did all this work in Washington.
because it's the place that she considered her true home. It's the place that she came back to year after year. It's where her roots were. It's where her ancestors were. And there is a marvelous place here. We call her, it's the National Historic Landmark, the Frances Perkins Homestead National Historic Landmark, but it was the home for seven generations of her family. So she came here every summer as a child and throughout her life until she died in 1965.
And she's buried there. I want to ask you, Sarah, what do you believe was Maine's influence on the life's work of Frances Perkins? How did her Maine background influence the work that she did? In some ways, one might say it didn't. She grew up in a rural, her Maine background was very rural, and so much of what she did was fighting for example, factory workers in big cities.
It was rural, but she was very much part of the Newcastle community when she was here. And the homestead is actually, you see it today, it looks like a beautiful farmstead. It's a saltwater farm, but it was actually an industrial site as well. The family had a brickworks on the river for 100 years that they worked along with hired people as part of the farm economy. And she was a sociable kid, we know, according to Kirsten's book and letters that we've read. And so she saw and knew people working every day in a really tough industry, a dirty, hard-working kind of life. And she was exposed to that. She was very aware of it and curious about it. And she spoke to people. She was a very friendly kid from everything we can hear. So it was very much part of her growing up. She was also quite aware of the history of this place and very interested in that always. Her grandmother, who she admired very much and throughout her life, Frances Perkins would quote her grandmother as a great influence on her. She was a couple generations removed from the Revolutionary War and told stories and had memories. So it was the early roots of her ancestors in this place that were so very important to her. And we think it really formed her character and shaped the direction her life took.
Michael, this has been a big year for the Frances Perkins Center. Tell us about it.
Well, we've been in existence since 2009, and since about 2011 or 12, the idea began to become reality that we could mount a fundraising campaign to purchase the homestead from Frances Perkins' grandson. And we've worked steadily at that since that time. And in January, we completed the acquisition. And we're thrilled to have worked with Tomlin Coggeshall and his husband, Christopher Rice, to make this a reality. And we look forward to working together with them and all of our board and constituents to make this a truly public place.
All right. We're talking about Frances Perkins on Maine Calling. We'd love to have you join the conversation. The phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Let's dig in and talk a little bit about Frances Perkins' life. Kirsten, we've talked about how even though she was born in Massachusetts, deep family roots in Maine. And it's clear that being the first female cabinet member of any president's cabinet is a major accomplishment. But Frances Perkins was also notable in that she got there completely because of the work that she had done in the past. She wasn't a woman whose husband had died, for example, or whose husband had a powerful position, and that's why she was appointed to the position she was. And I understand that even by the standards of her generation, going to college was remarkable.
It really was. Just about everything about Frances Perkins was really unusual. she was ahead of her time. One of the things that's very interesting is she was 40 years old before she even had the right to vote. And she was an important public figure even before she had the right to vote. She was a very important campaigner for workplace safety laws after she witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist fire. And then she went on the New York Industrial Commission. And this is one of the things that made her so valuable to FDR, was that she had both her social work experience of knowing about people's social problems, but as a longtime industrial commissioner, she also understood business problems very well. And she brought those two things together when she went to work for FDR, and as they set to try to deal with the problems that had been created by the Great Depression. She understood both sides of the equation. And to me, that's a really interesting thing right now, because her handiwork is completely the mechanism we're using now to get through this coronavirus crisis.
That's right. I do want to bring the conversation to the present, because so much of what she's done is so important. And I'll do that in just a couple minutes. But Sarah, Kirsten mentioned something that I think is really important, which is the Triangle Shirtwaist fire. We've all read about that in history books and know how horrific it was. But it was perhaps fate. Some might argue that Frances Perkins witnessed that personally.
Yes. Again, she was a resident of the neighborhood of Greenwich Village in around that time. An interesting aside is that she was friends with the artists and writers and social commentators. It was a very lively scene there. But she happened to be having tea in with some friends right across the street. It's around Washington Square. I know the spot really well because I went to graduate school there. It's where NYU is right now. This was the worst single industrial accident in American history. People say that it was the worst accident certainly in New York until 9/11. 146 young people, mostly women, mostly immigrant women, who were working on the top floors of a loft building, making fashionable shirtwaist their blouses, and the doors were locked. There were so that they wouldn't steal things. There were no fire escapes. Just all the normal things that we consider basic safety practices now did not exist before that day. When we tell people about, and she saw what happened was that people jumped from the 8th and 9th floor because they there were not enough elevators to get down. It was a horrific, horrific scene. There was a great outpouring of anger in all of New York City, but Frances Perkins got the job of being the investigator for the Citizens Committee to find out what had happened and to make sure that it would never happen again. So she talked later about the New Deal beginning on March 25th, 1911, because through her work, it brought her to the attention of public figures in Albany, the state capital, and she went there and was involved with and very instrumental in establishing laws for the most basic fire safety and workplace safety standards that were in a couple of states at that time, but certainly not on a federal level. So that's where she learned her craft, first with Governor Al Smith and then with FDR when he was governor of New York.
Sure. We're talking about Frances Perkins. To bring us up to speed, because we do have to take a break, we've established that she has deep family connections to Maine, was a young social worker working in New York and witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist fire, and then became appointed as the person who would investigate that. She's going to go on to become FDR's Secretary of Labor, but we have to take a break. We will talk about that in just a minute. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Modern Pest Services, offering a non-toxic approach to pest control with Anti-CMEX Smart Pest Control Technology, modernpest.com, by the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom, uma.edu, and Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be a part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial, deadriver.com. The Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus has now gone to a regular twice-a-week schedule on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On these 2 days, it will normally happen at 2 o'clock each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, the briefings are archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is now normally scheduled for 2 o'clock on just Tuesday and Thursdays each week and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
Maine gave me my American dream. It gave me a higher education. It gave my children a great schools. Maine gave me a great, great job that I love. And I am also a city councilor for the beautiful city of South Portland. So I'm here and I'm here to stay. For me, when I run for office, it was all about me thinking, oh my goodness, I'm woman, I'm black, and I'm immigrant, I'm Muslim. I'm not gonna be able to connect anybody here. But it was amazing how welcoming and open arms were Mainers and also South Portland folks were.
This Is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to MainePublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the life and legacy of Frances Perkins, one of a series of programs we're doing to commemorate Maine's bicentennial. Joining me right now, Sarah Peskin and Michael Cheney, both with the Frances Perkins Center here in Maine. Also on the line with us, Kirsten Downey, who is author of The Woman Behind the New Deal. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Kirsten Downey, I'm going to fast forward to 1932 when FDR is elected and, you know, the nation is going through the Great Depression. And a lot happens in the first 100 days of FDR's presidency. What has Frances Perkins' fingerprints on it? What happened in that moment almost 90 years ago that still is so important today?
I'd say the biggest things were the public works programs, the introduction of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the beginnings of the initial early push for the Social Security Act, and that gave us Social Security, it gave us disability insurance, and it gave us our statewide unemployment insurance system. Those are some of the things that were done in those first 100 days to get launched. The Social Security Act passed actually in 1935. The early work began very quickly in that first 100 days, but it took a little bit longer to put it together. And of course, that's the thing that we're using so much today. Right now, we've got 65 million people on Social Security. Imagine the United States right now without Social Security. How many seniors have at least some degree of financial security because of its existence? And beyond that, right now, we've got 30 million people on unemployment insurance right now. So you add up those two programs together, and you've got 96 million people right now, this month, are getting financial assistance through programs that are Frances Perkins handiwork. These are both programs based on the fact that you qualified for them by working and earning the benefit. So we've set it up. There's been a big expansion of the of unemployment that occurred through the CARES Act, the Coronavirus Act back in March. And that most extraordinarily and wonderfully passed almost unanimously. It had almost full support in this very toxic political system. Frances Perkins' work has now reached the point that it has universal acceptance. Anyway, but if you want to add up those two things together, the 96, you know, the 30 and the 65, and you come up with the 95, that's actually half of our whole American adult work population right now. So imagine America right now without Frances Perkins, without those 30, you know, that first 100 days that got all this started and the accomplishments that she had.
And Kirsten, at the time, the idea of Social Security was beyond radical, correct?
There was beginning to be some awareness that Social Security might be a good thing to do. I think there was some support for the idea of a federal or a pension system in some places. The thing that was considered super radical at that time, though, was unemployment insurance. It was actually just like a laugh line in a comedy show that you'd say, oh, and we're going to give people unemployment insurance. Ha, 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 that's so funny. Well, in fact, what we found is it's been a great tool for us to use every time we have an economic downturn. Putting together a whole federal system of Social Security, the pension system, was almost unimaginable at that time, too. Really two extraordinary accomplishments.
Michael, I'm sure you've been doing a lot of thinking right now as we go through this time with COVID-19 about Frances Perkins' legacy and wondering, what would she be thinking today?
Well, she would be taking every single challenge before us, taking it apart, examining the data, and coming up with a plan to address the problem. She wasn't about quick fixes and Band-Aid approaches, but how do you change and tweak a system to deal with a new reality? So that's where her mind would be, is looking at, okay, the situation is here. What are we going to do about it for the greater good of everyone?
We'll go to Thankful, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Thankful. Go ahead.
Hi. My question has to do with, I understand that Frances Perkins had a friendship and certainly had many issues of a similar mind to Eleanor Roosevelt. And I just wondered if your guests might comment on how the two of them collaborated in some cases on things like labor and Social Security, education, et cetera.
Kirsten, you want to take that?
Yeah, I would describe them as friendly allies, but not particularly close friends. In a lot of ways, they were very, very different. Eleanor grew into her stature. She grew into the public role that she had that we knew her with when she was First Lady. But Frances Perkins had been in the public eye from a very young age. Frances Perkins had gone to college, which made her unique. Only about 3% of American women had gone to college. And Eleanor Roosevelt, although she was highly intelligent, never went to college. So there were some things that caused a little bit of chafing in the relationship early on. And of course, Eleanor Roosevelt was very wealthy, and Frances Perkins had to scramble for a living. So that was yet another difference between them. But they shared the common goals and a common sense of the desire to try to make the world a safer, better place for all Americans. Frances Perkins was great at coming up with ideas and coming up with ways to implement them. And Eleanor Roosevelt was wonderfully gifted at explaining things in small words so that everyone could understand and popularizing these ideas. So together, the women worked very closely without being best of friends.
Thankful. Thank you for your question. An email here from Gray. Has the painting of Frances Perkins that Governor LePage removed from the Labor Department building been returned to its and her rightful place? Sarah, I'll turn to you. And this mural, Frances Perkins is one person in a much larger mural.
Yes.
As I understand, it's right where the whole public can see it outside of the Maine State Archives next to the museum. Will it stay there or go back to the Department of Labor? Do you know?
I understand that it will stay there. This is the beautiful mural by Judy Taylor. And it's actually, I think, found a great home there because it's in a much more visible place. The Department of Labor offices are a rental building, so there, it's not guaranteed that they would always be there, but the museum will be there. And many more people every day come back and forth. This is, again, where the library and museum, it's right in the lobby, and there is an interpretive video along with it that explains it's the history of labor in Maine. Francis Perkins happens to be featured in one of the panels, but the background goes much earlier, and it's explained very, very well. So as far as I know, it will be there for the duration.
All right. Well, we're going to go right to Newcastle and Tomlin. Tomlin, you're Francis Perkins' grandson?
Yes, I am.
Did you know your grandmother?
I did. I was 11 when she died, so I knew her mainly as just a loving grandmother. She never really got into her political career with me, but I've learned a lot about that since then, of course. But, yeah, I just wanted to call in from the family homestead and say how nice it is to hear everybody, giving a great overview of her life and to thank everyone for being interested in her, who's listening, and, just to give a sense of, I think it's probably coming clear, but we sometimes boil down her focus in her work was basically two things, social justice and economic security, improving both of those for everyone in the country. And she also said that she thought the purpose of government should be to give all the people under its jurisdiction the best possible life. So we try to carry that on.
Tomlin, I want to keep you on the phone for a moment and ask any of our guests if they have a question for Tomlin.
Yeah.
We fortunately get to see Tomlin quite a bit. So we're constantly asking Tomlin all kinds of questions.
What about you, Kirsten, from Hawaii?
Well, yeah. I'm delighted to hear your voice, Tomlin. I love you. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Kirsten. It's great to hear yours, too. We should have an offline chat, too, to catch up.
We became very close when I was researching the book, and I spent a lot of time at the homestead with Tomlin, and he was very helpful with providing me with information and insight, all kinds of insights about his incredible grandmother and her wonderful life.
All right. Well, Tomlin,
yes,
thank you.
It was the fact that Kirsten was writing her book, The Woman Behind the New Deal, that came out in 2009, that gave me a sense that there was something really wonderful and special about my grandmother that could be worth having a center about her that would be potentially based at her her family homestead in Newcastle, Maine, at that time potentially, but now it's become reality.
Well, Tomlin, I really appreciate you taking the time to call in. I appreciate that so much. One of the things, Kirsten, I learned from your book is that there were some things that were left unfinished, and so fascinating to think that one of the great regrets of Frances Perkins' life is that she was not able to pass universal health care.
Yes. When she joined the FDR's cabinet as Secretary of Labor, she came on with a little working list that she had of the things that she wanted to do. And as she'd get each thing accomplished, she could kind of in her mind check it off. And the one thing she wanted to have was universal health care. Instead, World War II came up. They never got around to it. They got a lot of opposition from the American Medical Association. In any case, health insurance has always been a really big and difficult issue for Americans. Instead, we ended up with this makeshift program that we got in the United States as a result of people trying to get around the wage and price freeze that went in World War II. Employers came to the FDR administration and said, can we give medical insurance as a benefit instead of raising wages? Because you don't want us to raise wages because it'll cause inflation. And FDR and Frances Perkins fought it over, and they said, well, that makes sense. Well, what ended up happening was a huge expansion of voluntary medical health insurance. All kinds of unions got it immediately and very quickly for their own members. And then many companies brought on health insurance as a way to keep unionization out. And we ended up having very many employers in the country use that as a key benefit. The only thing that's a problem with unemployment insurance based on employment is that you have to be employed to have it. So now we've got a situation, what we're seeing unfold before us right now, is that a lot of people have lost their employment. Losing their employment, they've lost their health insurance. And the New York Times just this week had a story that said that, you know, 5.4 million people have recently lost their health insurance. And I think this is really one of the things that has to be revisited very soon.
We're talking about the life and the legacy and the relevance today of the work of Frances Perkins. We'd love to hear your comment or question. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Cancer Specialists. Proud to be a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative. Learn more at newenglandcancerspecialists.com. And Bristol Seafood of Maine, dedicated to bringing restaurant-quality meals to your kitchen with My Fish Dish, found in the freezer at your local Hannaford.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On July 15, 1980, the Maine moose hunt was revived after a 45-year ban. The state reintroduced moose hunting in 1980 on a limited basis, then instituted a moose lottery in 1982. Immediately, hunters applied, hoping to have their name chosen and have the opportunity to hunt for moose. Today, Maine's moose hunt is a permit-only hunt. This year, the state's Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife awarded 3,135 permits from a total of 65,634 applications. It is estimated that Maine currently has between 60,000 and 70,000 moose roaming the outdoors.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine!
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, Dr. Ibram Kendi and Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith join us for a deep dive into the issue of racial injustice. How can parents discuss racism and systemic injustice with their children? How can they ensure that future generations help to solve the problem instead of exacerbate it? On the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
Coming up shortly at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing the impact of Frances Perkins, both during her time in the FDR administration and how her accomplishments are relevant now during the pandemic. My guest, Michael Chaney, who is executive director of the Frances Perkins Center, Sarah Peskin, who's board chair of the Frances Perkins Center, and Kirsten Downey, a journalist and author of a biography of Frances Perkins. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Michael, I want to ask you about the mission of the center, because I understand it really is about more than just letting people know about Frances Perkins.
Well, as Tomlin said, the focus of the Perkins Center is on her legacy and focus on social justice and economic security. And that in American society, we need constant vigilance to ensure that everyone is enjoying the best possible life, and that no matter what station you are in life and where you happen to live, or whether you're in industry or in a rural area, that you have an ability to live a good life and a just life. And our mission is, yes, to take care of the Perkins family homestead, but also to produce programs for adult and in-school audiences that call attention to the importance of social justice and economic security in the decades to come.
All right. And Sarah, you have a big event that is usually coming up in August. What are you doing this year about the garden party?
Well, we're following the spirit of Frances Perkins, who was undaunted by incredible challenges, and we're going virtual. We're reinventing the what would normally be an outdoor event, but we're celebrating our founders. We have a very wonderful speaker, one of the great historians, Alice Kessler Harris, will be addressing us. She's a former president of the American Historical Association and recently retired from Columbia University as an authority on both labor history and women's history. And we hope everyone will tune in at that at 5 o'clock on August 16th and raise a glass to Frances Perkins. One of the things that we've learned, again, from starting with Kirsten's biography, but also from further research and delving into the archives and letters, is that Frances Perkins was a full human being. She had a great sense of humor. She enjoyed a good drink. She worked with people together to form solutions. They were almost always in law and policy, but she worked as a team with experts and regular people and pulled all these ideas together. So we try to work that same way, and we're teaching people to use the way she worked and her as a role model for many of us. We want to encourage people to go into public service. That's a big part of our mission, and we're able to teach it from the place that she loved. So we're doing it virtually this year. We're sure that in years to come we'll be back at the homestead. So that's essentially what we're up to, and Michael can tell you more about how to sign up and all the specifics, but they're all on our website.
It's just go to the Frances Perkins website, www.francisperkinscenter.org. This virtual program starts at 5 p.m. It's going to be on YouTube Live, but on our homepage is all the info you need to be able to participate, and that's Sunday, August 16th.
And we'll provide links to that as well. One of the things that strikes me, Kirsten, and when you were just a few minutes ago talking about how the idea of health insurance being tied to your employment, how that got started in our culture, is that there are a lot of things in this book, a lot of the facets of Frances Perkins' life that from today's lens, we don't think about it that way anymore, but there was a different incentive. And one of the things I remember reading was that Frances Perkins was behind the 40-hour work week, not because she thought people needed a break as much as she wanted employers to employ more people.
Well, that was, I think it was both things. I think as a understanding sort of the business mind, they wanted to stimulate consumer spending. And they said, if you get more people employed, we'll get more spending going on, that will boost the economy. And of course, that's true. On the other hand, she was also very aware of the need, the human need for leisure and for rest, to recover, to be able to do a good job the next day. One of the reasons she really loved Maine was she would go there every year and take a good long rest in August in Maine. But it was a combination of both things. She thought it was good for people, and she also thought a 40-hour work week was good for people and also good for the economy.
Right. So if there were if factories, for example, had a 40-hour shift instead of 80 hours a week, they'd employ twice as many people.
That's right.
Yeah. We're going to go to Anne, who's calling in Falmouth. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have a question I don't believe you've addressed yet. I'm a proud alum of Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts. And I'm wondering if the author has any insight into how Frances Perkins' educational experience at Mount Holyoke impacted on her decision to enter the political arena. What I know about Frances Perkins at Mount Holyoke is she was a combined chemistry and physics major, and she was the president of her student body. And we now at Mount Holyoke have a program for non-traditional older women to achieve a college degree at an older age. So she's very important in the alum community at Mount Holyoke. It's the oldest women's college in the country and one of the Seven Sisters.
Kirsten.
Well, everything that Frances Perkins was informed by her experience at Mount Holyoke. It really made her the woman that she was. And of course, you know, she was also very strong part of the Mount Holyoke community. She was president of her senior class. I think one of the things that really tells us what she was going to do in her life is that they picked their motto the year she graduated and she led the class. It was be steadfast, be steadfast. And in fact, that's what she was. The founding mission of Mount Holyoke, which was founded by the great educator Mary Lyons. Female education was so rare at the time that Mary Lyons lived that she was even afraid to call Mount Holyoke a college. They called it a seminary at first as a way to avoid the backlash they would get for educating women. Mary Lyons' goal was to create a group of women that had a sense of mission, who were infused with a sense of social justice, and who wanted to do community service. And everything that Mary Lyons wanted was what Frances Perkins put into effect in her own life. So Mount Holyoke, yes, had a huge impact on Frances Perkins.
Anne, thank you so much for your call. An email here from Isolina. After college, Frances Perkins held a variety of teaching positions, including a position teaching chemistry at Ferry Hall School, now Lake Forest Academy in Illinois. In Chicago, she volunteered at settlement houses, including Hull House, where she worked with Jane Addams. That's quite a coincidence as well, isn't it, Kirsten?
Well, I told you a few minutes ago, and you start to get after a while like, is there a room that she wasn't in? It's really extraordinary how many people she met and how engaged she was in the world in so many ways.
How you were talking about the difficulty even navigating a college education as a woman in her time. What about after that? How was it that Frances Perkins navigated, gosh, the word today would be sexism, but I'm sure it was overt and just overwhelming. How did she make it in a man's world?
It was a constant challenge for her. When she joined the cabinet, there wasn't even a title for a woman cabinet officer. And so she had to develop that term, a term was developed, Madam Secretary, to address women secretaries of the cabinet. Now, something that we take for granted. Very few colleges admitted women. For her to go to get her graduate degree, she ended up going to Columbia, which was one of the few places that accepted women graduate students. She also found that men were so off put by having a woman in a business meeting or in a business setting that she had to adopt a kind of persona that they found acceptable. And she noticed over time how their faces relaxed and they got more easy and comfortable when they thought about their mothers. So she began consciously to try to dress herself like a matronly mother. And she found that men just took to her much more easily if they felt like they were talking to dear old mom.
And she even changed her name from Fanny to Frances because it was...
Yes.
Could have been
Fanny
a man's name.
It's a name with some negative associations. Frances is gender neutral. There's some advantages. She was very strategic.
Before we wrap up, I'm going to put you all on the spot, depending how much time we have, but I'll start with you, Sarah. Do you have a favorite Frances Perkins story?
Yes. There are many of them, but I would just say that the fact that she was the person who convinced FDR that artists and creative people were workers and should be included in the jobs programs. And that was really unusual, and I had to tease it out of oral histories and letters, but I think we can thank her for the murals and the theater and the other creative productions that the New Deal is very famous for.
Michael.
She thought that it was absurd that a person would lose their income because they were too old to work, that life should not end economically because you're no longer able to work. And that was the whole basis of the Social Security system. You worked your entire life, you were entitled to be taken care of when you could no longer work.
Ironic, because she worked right up until her last day.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, Kirsten, I know this is really going to be difficult for you, but what do you find yourself telling people again and again at cocktail parties and the like?
I often will say to them at some point, do you know one person on Social Security? Do you know two people on Social Security? Imagine America without Social Security. Imagine the impact she's had. Now, right now, we've got a really scary situation with the coronavirus, and a lot of people are losing their jobs. But there's a full third of the adult population has financial security right now because they are recipients of Social Security. And that, I think, is Frances Perkins' most extraordinary handiwork and what the gift she's given to the American people.
Do you think she had any sense of, I mean, obviously she knew that she was changing the structure of American policy, but if she could transport herself to today, would she be satisfied? Would she be surprised?
Well, I think she would be preparing a new list. And there'd be a number of things. She'd probably be seeing some flaws right now. We've got some underfunded unemployment insurance systems around the country. Texas, California, New York don't have enough money. They're only, you know, many of the states are in that way. And she left on health insurance. She did not complete the work on health insurance. And we continue to have problems with getting people safe and affordable health care.
Well, what a wonderful conversation. And like I said earlier, anything today that was mentioned on the program, the link to the Frances Perkins Center website, information about Kirsten Downey's wonderful book, will all be on our webpage and on our Facebook page. Thank you to our guest today, the voice you just heard, Kirsten Downey, who is a journalist and author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor, and Moral Conscience. Sarah Peskin is board chair of the Frances Perkins Center, and Michael Cheney is the executive director of the Frances Perkins Center. The homestead is in Newcastle. Sandra Harris ran the board today, and today's program will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.